relief and elimination of odious regulations in the name of liberation. It seems the people want the freedom Straker promised, but they don't want to pay for it.
Not my problem, snapped Engels. The Senate will have to come up with the money somehow, unless they want the Huns to gobble up everything.
It is our problem, Admiral,
Nolan replied.
I've been among bureaucrats for over 80 years. Zaxby is almost 200, and Indy processes thought faster than either of us. Together, Trinity assesses that our war efforts will soon fail, not from lack of tactical leadership or even of military strategy, but from economics and governance. That's always the Hundred Worlds' advantage. The Republic has inherited a collectivist system that barely functions. We need years, perhaps decades, to reinvent ourselves. Barring that, we need a government that knows how to get the most out of the aging dinosaur of a bureaucracy.
Great, Engels replied. That's the problem. What's the solution? She looked around.
Anyone?
Benota cleared his throat and stood. I hate to say I told you so, but I did. Liberation is all well and good, but right now we need a strong hand to manage the economy until the war is over and we can transition to a less regulated model.
You want to be the economic czar as well as the Minister of War?
Not me, no.
Who then?
We already have a director, though Straker sharply curtailed his powers. I suggest we use him.
De Chang?
Engels's tone was skeptical.
He's dangerous. Too ambitious.
Admiral Gray stage-coughed.
I've known Emilio for quite a while. He's vain and he's arrogant, but he's also visionary and competent. It was his vision for a war-winning battleship that got him squeezed out of the committee. But it turned out he was ahead of his time. Remember, without Indomitable, the liberation would have failed. Yes, he'd like to be the big boss again, but even at its worst, the mutuality was no dictatorship. If our new republic can't channel one man's ambition, it's not worth saving.
So how do we channel his ambition? Engels asked.
Benota said, Before the Senate gets too comfortable with the Liberator's absence and realize they're really in charge, I'll work with De Chang to pass an expansion of his executive tax and spend powers. Only for the duration of the war, of course.
Fine, Engels replied. How does that get us the forces we need for this fight, and for the next fight, and the next? And we're not even talking about the opters yet.
Benota bounced his ham-like fist on the table. The VR sim was so good, Engels could hardly tell the man wasn't really in the room. We'll get you the forces for your Battle of Calypso. We may have to strip the rear areas of everything, we may have to create money we don't have, and make promises we can't keep. But we'll get you your ships. Heavens help us if you lose, though. The Republic won't survive it.
Engels drew herself up. I won't lose. We won't lose. If everyone here does their duty and there are no leaks of this plan, then we'll hurt the Huns so badly they'll have to negotiate.
Chapter 6 Straker in Opterland. 12 side-space transit days later, as he and Myrmidon approached their destination deep in Opter space, Straker was still smarting from Carla Engels's harsh words aimed at his stupidity and pig-headedness in going alone.
Our new enemies want you dead, and the mutuality restored. And you go and hand yourself over to them without even bringing Loco to watch your back?
She'd yelled over the comlink. Can you imagine Loco on a sensitive spy mission? She'd ignored that.
And even worse, you're not even going to come see me first.
No time, my love, he'd said. Every delay gives the Opters more chances to raid us, and for the Hundred Worlds to push deeper into our territory. You and Gray and Benota can handle the Huns and the War of Fleets. I'm not a critical factor there.
But only I can deal with the Opters, and that means understanding them, finding out the truth. Engels had ranted and raved, but he'd held firm. Now he and Myrmidon had arrived at the Alka system, deep in Opter territory, traveling on the agent's fast courier. And she was fast. The same trip would have taken a capital ship 6 weeks or more and exhausted her fuel. Despite the speed, Straker was ready to get out of the cramped little vessel. The days had, however, given him the leisure to talk at length with Myrmidon, or Don, as he liked to call himself.
Don is a common enough phoneme in Earthen and most of the old Earth languages that it usually passes easily on human worlds, he explained.
Straker had tried without success to find any holes in Don's long skeins of conversation, his easy explanations of his views on Opters and humanity and the aliens on their various borders. He'd learned a lot, but he still had the nagging feeling he was being subtly led towards some viewpoint Don wanted. Straker hoped he survived the visit. This deep in enemy territory, everything became a long shot. And until now, the Opter man had provided proof of nothing. That was obviously about to change, as the screen showed multiple Opter ships plying the routes among the various planets, moons, and facilities of the Alka system. Most of these were smaller than those humans would use, or at least the crew portions were. Some of the freighters, for example, appeared to be composed of small, powerful tugs with cargo modules attached, rather than the usual earthen arrangement of a hulled ship with internal bays. Probably Opters needed fewer amenities than humans. Don brought his scout ship into a planetary docking ring, a massive, amazing structure that floated above the planet's equator in a perfect geosynchronous orbit. More than 25,000 kilometers in circumference, it was attached to the world with dozens of space elevators, like spokes in a wheel.
This is a far more efficient system to access space than fusion-powered ships individually ascending and descending. It uses less energy, needs less gravitic compensation, and provides a better platform for orbital industry than parked asteroids, Don said.
It's also extremely fragile. Vulnerable to attack or sabotage, replied Straker. Hit an asteroid with a bomb or missile and you damage only that facility. This thing? If you could crack the structure, I bet the entire thing would unravel, buckle, and come apart.
Less than you might think. The materials used are stronger than duranium, based on genetically engineered spider silk infused with graphenoid molecules. And Opter society is far less vulnerable to infiltration by humans. In a pinch, every Opter would take up arms for the defense of nest and hive.
Meaning, you think you're superior?
We are, in some ways. In the most obvious ones, perhaps. In others, no. I've come to respect humans on the whole, even while as individuals you vary wildly and fail miserably to cooperate.
Don caught Straker's gaze.
I've also come to realize that there is no one definition of superior. The human definition usually compares symmetries and declares one thing better than the other. That's easy when militaries go head-to-head. It is not so easy in deciding, say, which approach to survival is better. Your dinosaurs dominated old Earth until an asteroid radically cooled their environment. All their size, ferocity, and so-called superiority suddenly became irrelevant when their food sources vanished. Smaller, hardier things survived where the giants could not. In fact, dinosaur became a metaphor for that which is doomed to extinction.
Straker grunted. Adapt or die, I know that.
Don turned away. Well summarized. But do you truly understand?
Straker had no answer, and so he changed the subject. I take it this is a Miskor world?
Oh, no, Derek. This is a Sarmak hive system with only Sarmak nests.
Don stood from his pilot's seat and picked up a duffel bag he'd prepared beforehand and gestured for Straker to pick up his own. He then took a few steps to the ship's exit portal and pressed his palm to the sensor pad. The door opened wide onto an enormous flight deck for small craft. Beings of all sorts scurried to and fro with tremendous purpose. Some of their errands seemed inscrutable, but some were obvious. Loaders pushing cargo, creatures with duffels not unlike Straker's own, maintainers with tools, refuelers with tanks and hoses. The surprise for Straker was the high proportion of humans. Okay, bipeds at least, he could see. There were only a few dog bees, a smattering of armed warrior wasps, and a fair number of the worker ants, composing perhaps a third of the beings here. The rest had two legs and two arms, and many seemed indistinguishable from humans. Some had odd coloring, green, purple, bright red, and some had abnormal skin, scaly or chitinous or moist and glistening. But about half could have passed unnoticed on human worlds.
"Welcome to Terra Nova," Don said.
"What?" Straker said sharply. "That means New Earth, right? That's pretty ballsy, you Opters calling this place after humanity's home."
"You've never even been to Old Earth," he said.
"Doesn't matter."
"And if the Sarmak have their way, this is the breeding ground of a new humanity."
"Meaning?"
"You'll see."
Don took a step, but Straker grabbed his arm.
"And how do I fit in here? Won't they spot me or smell me as different and arrest me?" "I took the liberty of altering your biochemistry slightly."
Straker shook the smaller man roughly. "You did what?" Don looked down at Straker's grip, then back up to his eyes.
"Don't be a pussy, Derek. Your Hawk biotech made you 90% Opter, as far as the average facet you encounter can tell. I merely tweaked your scent to add Sarmak pheromone markers like my own. Only if you're subjected to deeper bioanalysis could someone tell you're not hive-raised."
"I don't trust you, damn it." Don peeled Straker's thumb and fingers off his arm.
"Don't be an idiot. You put yourself in my hands when you decided to come with me. Make a decision and stick with it. Otherwise, I might as well take you back right now."
"Okay, then, let's go back." Myrmidon took a deep breath, sighed, shook his head, and turned back to his scout ship.
"Great. Another 5 days cooped up in a ship with no shower, and you."
"Wait."
"What?"
"We'll stay. I was testing you."
Don's mouth curled as he looked sidelong at Straker.
"I know."
"You know?"
"This is my area of expertise, remember?"
"What? Deception?"
"Spycraft. Psychological combat. Manipulation. You can't beat me at my own game, Derek. You have to decide to trust me. You're in my hands, just like I decided to put myself in your hands when I came to you."
Straker rubbed the back of his neck. "But if you're like the rest of these Opter creatures, these facets, you called them, then you're programmed to consider yourself expendable, so you wouldn't actually care whether you live or die. In fact, there could be 1,000 Myrmidons cloned to look and act the same and infiltrate us."
"That's very astute. There are many of our infiltrators in your society, some highly placed indeed. And as I said, I've spent years living among you. But as for clones, every being with free will quickly becomes individualized once he lives among you. Your very randomness and lack of regimentation assures it. And once each of us assimilates into human culture, we're free to defect, to form our own goals, morality, and beliefs about right and wrong. If we acted like Opters, we'd never blend in. A perfect fake, if truly perfect, is no longer a fake. It becomes real."
Straker barked a laugh. "All that philosophy is so much mental bullshit. You spin these theories that sound good, but in the end, what matters is that you're so good at faking that we can't tell. Not without tests, like you said. So, So? So you're right. I have to act like I trust you even if I really don't. The dice are cast. Straker stuck a finger in Don's chest. But I'm watching you.
Fair enough.
Don turned to walk toward a distant portal.
Now, let's get going before we attract attention. Human ops are given a lot of leeway, but the insectoid facets still tend to regard us as dangerously unstable. There have been cases of warriors killing us because they misunderstood some action that humans would find commonplace.
Straker followed alongside.
Such as?
Such as getting drunk and starting a fist fight. Insectoids interpret that as a facet gone insane.
Okay, no barroom brawls.
We'll see about that.
Meaning?
Meaning, once we're on the surface, different rules apply.
There are areas where human facets are given completely free rein, no matter the results.
No matter the results? That's what I said.
So they won't interfere?
Not once we're on the surface. But we'll still have to play our roles. I'm an agent. You're my trainee. Try to act like it.
Myrmidon wouldn't answer any more questions about what that meant, so Straker allowed himself to be led along. After a minimum of processing, which consisted of a quick scan of his body and his baggage, they boarded a train down the nearest cable. Cable was a pale, weak word for the connecting tether their vehicle traversed. The tether measured at least 100 meters across, and the train's grav plating was set so that Straker felt as if they traveled upon a long, thin bridge from the ring behind them to the vertical wall of the blue planet in front of them. The top and sides of the train cars were made of transparent crystal. Apparently, even opters liked to take in the view as they traveled. All of their fellow passengers were humanoid. Most of the exotics, that's what Don called the non-standard ones, spoke some kind of clicking opter language with each other. The standard humans mostly used Earthen in a variety of perfectly ordinary accents, though two conversed in what Straker guessed was Chinese.
"This is creepy," said Straker. "I feel like I could be arriving at any human planet."
"Then we've done our job well," Don replied. Straker realized he was speaking of the opters, or maybe just the Sarmak, when he said we, as others around them might overhear.
"Yes, we have," Straker said, and reminded himself to be cautious.
As he observed the fake humans, his main impression was of childlike happiness. Unlike Myrmidon, they didn't seem like they would fit in with human society. Or if they did, real humans would find them odd. He tried to figure out what it was. They acted like kids in grown-up bodies, he realized, like ordinary civilian children untouched by hardship, as he was before the Hawk killed his family. Not like the cadets at academy, too old before their time and training for war. Yet they looked like adults. One woman stood out from the crowd, though. Her measured gaze was different, direct and confident, and she glanced across the car at them a little too often. Straker nudged Don. "We're being watched."
"I know," Don murmured. "But now she knows you know, and now that you told me, she knows I know, too. You make a bad spy, Derek."
"Who is she?"
"A new operative, testing out her skills in a closed environment."
Don reached inside his tunic and produced a small leather folder, which he opened in her direction and then shut with a snap. She nodded and departed the car.
"She won't bother us again."
"You sure there aren't others watching?"
"If they are, they're using technical means, not their own eyes. As my trainee, the watchers will expect you to make mistakes. But if you make too many, I might have to send you back to the larval pods, get it?"
Straker processed this odd declaration, remembering Don was speaking for the benefit of possible listeners.
"Sure, Don. I'll try to do better.
Sometimes I try too hard to act like one of those crazy, weird humans.
Yes, and you're doing it now.
Sorry, just practicing.
Straker shut up for a while until the transport approached the surface. When they were perhaps 20 kilometers from the surface, which still looked to Straker like a wall rather than the ground, he realized the scale of the construction he could see and the extent of the cityscape.
How many people live here on Terra Nova? Straker asked.
I don't know.
Guess.
Don turned blandly toward Straker.
A trillion? Two?
Straker swallowed.
1,000 billion? That seems impossible. That's 100 planets worth of people on one world. How do you feed everyone?
With technology and enough energy, anything's possible. The environment is completely geoengineered.
Cities extend downward more than 1,000 meters in many places, with plenty of hydroponic farms.
Rather than thinking of Terra Nova as a planet, think of it as a giant habitat that happens to be big enough to sustain an atmosphere.
It's a damn hive.
You're starting to see.
When the train arrived at the Terra Nova surface, it followed a curving track that left all the cars resting on level ground. The two men stepped out into a station that could have come from any human planet. Signs directed travelers to other tracks where trains would take them to destinations with half-familiar names, like Caledonia, Hong Kong, and Shepperton. Cafes and restaurants served food and drink to the populace, and music wafted from a piano a woman played near a fountain.
"This is one of the weirdest things I've ever seen," Straker muttered.
"On the contrary, Derek, it's one of the most ordinary things you've ever seen. What makes it weird is that you know it's all manufactured and contrived.
Like an amusement park, where the building fronts look like houses or hotels, but they actually contain rides."
Don nodded.
"It's the dissonance between the appearance and the underlying truth that gets you. In fact, new agents feel the same on their first assignments on a human world, except they have to accept that it's real, and the exercises are over. If they get caught, they might never come back."
"So they do get caught?"
"Of course. The human intelligence services apprehend our people quite often."
"So they know about our infiltration?"
"Certain spy divisions know or suspect, but our agents' biology is flawless, so those caught are generally believed to be from their human enemies, or from independent worlds."
Myrmidon began walking, and Straker followed.
"Let's get going."
"Where to?"
Straker asked.
"Baltimore."
"That's a place, right?"
"Yes. It's named for a city on old Earth."
Myrmidon bought tickets with an ordinary credit stick. A maglev train whisked them hundreds of kilometers through a tube evacuated of air, allowing the vehicle to reach speeds impossible in atmosphere. 20 minutes later, they walked out onto the streets of Baltimore. Straker stopped abruptly, shocked at what he saw, as the crystal doors of the train station slammed shut behind him. Ragged, filthy people stared at him, some drinking from liquor bottles, smoking various weeds, or even shooting drugs into their veins. They sat or lounged on streets littered with garbage or leaned against buildings covered with graffiti. Broken windows gaped like the mouths of concrete monsters, and a stench filled the air.
"What the hell?" he said.
"Yes, and welcome to it,"
Don replied. He shoved away a panhandler who stuck a hand in his face and mumbled something incoherent.
"Better get moving. Remember, this is a Diz."
"Diz?"
"That's what we call these enclaves, like Baltimore."
"Why Diz?"
"Some old Earth name for an artificial environment. Dizzyland, I think they call them."
He stepped out into the empty street and walked down the middle as far away from the denizens of the cityscape as possible. Straker stayed close,
trying to watch everywhere at once. They rounded a corner and nearly walked into a full-blown riot. Dozens of uniformed police were beating civilians with batons, while other civilians threw rocks and bottles at them. Chemical smoke stung Straker's eyes. An officer took out a slug thrower, not a stunner, and fired, hitting one of the rock throwers in the neck. She fell and began to bleed profusely. "What the hell is this place?" Straker asked as Myrmidon drew him back into an alley out of the way. "Why are they rioting?"
"Who knows? Food shortages, police brutality, their sports team, lost or won, it doesn't matter. All our human facets have to go through Baltimore."
"Ah, like an amusement park, right? A diz." Straker chuckled, understanding. "It's an exercise. Special effects, fake blood."
Don shook his head. "No, it's not an exercise, not the way you mean. It's artificial, but there's nothing fake about it."
Straker stepped out to look again at the woman lying in the street, the red pool expanding on the pavement.
"You mean she's really been shot?"
"Yes."
"Shit."
Straker sprinted to her and threw himself to the ground. The woman looked up at him with glassy eyes and gasped.
"You're gonna be all right," he said. He reached beneath his tunic and ripped off part of his undershirt, tried to staunch the bleeding.
A blow on the back of his head surprised him, and his combat reflexes took over. He rolled to his feet and found himself facing an officer with a baton.
"Back off, scumbag," the cop said. "You're interfering with police business."
Straker snatched the club from the officer's hands and threw it away. The man clawed for his holster, and Straker took that weapon away from him as well.
"What's wrong with you?" he asked. "Call an ambulance. You're a police officer. Do your job."
The man backed up and, with one eye on Straker, ran for two of his fellows. Don grabbed Straker's elbow and pulled.
"Stop it, Derek. You're interfering with the diz."
He dragged at Straker's arm.
"We need to go."
"But that woman's dying."
"That's an appropriate response, trainee,"
Don said loudly.
"But you're here so you can get used to the barbaric human callousness and brutality you'll see in the field."
He shoved Straker away.
"There's nothing you can do. Do you want to be sent back to the pods for recycling? You have to purge yourself of your morality. Remember, you're supposed to have been through Baltimore."
Straker was about to push Don aside and go back to the woman when he saw that the pump of her arterial blood had stopped, and her eyes were open and staring. Five cops approached with drawn slug throwers, and one more had a heavy stunner. Reluctantly, Straker ran with Don around a corner, reminding himself he was deep in enemy territory. Three turns of the ways later, Don led them into a blind alley with a door at the end that was marked with an abstract graphic symbol. Perhaps it was alien writing. Don placed his hand against a sensor pad, and it opened. They passed into a featureless corridor.
"That woman really died," Straker said.
"That facet did, yes."
Don gazed dispassionately at Straker.
"She was a slug, anyway."
"Slug?"
"A new humanoid facet, barely adult. Just enough education to make her fit for a diz like this. She was probably about 2 years old, with a lifespan of 6 or less, to make sure she didn't grow beyond her assigned limits."
Straker stared back at Myrmidon with disgust.
"You're breeding sentient beings just to kill them? That's evil."
Don shrugged.
"Welcome to the Diz."
Chapter 7 2 weeks after Admiral Ingalls's Council of War, Calypso System. Admiral Ingalls brooded on Indomitable's arena-shaped bridge. Clever use of grav plating made it possible to walk along the inside of the bowl without difficulty, and each section had a clear line of sight to every other. The only obstruction was the hologram that hung in the center, displaying the tactical and strategic situation in the area. Right now, Ingalls had it scaled to show the entire Calypso system out to flat space, its star and Felicity Station tiny near its center. For the last 3 days, the battleship and a force of every capital ship scraped up from this side of the Republic had waited, hidden deep inside the glowing ball of gas that surrounded the planet designated C-1. Hiding even a ship of indomitable size was easy. The gas was opaque to sensors beyond 100 kilometers, and even that close, the dense swirls mixed with thousands of rocks and captured asteroids to make detection and targeting problematic. A perfect place for an ambush. Her strategic feed came via hundreds of encrypted relay drones from stealthy passive sensors, seated in stellar orbits all across the system. In other words, Engels could see out, but the 100 Worlds fleet couldn't see in, assuming they showed. With its valuable fuel processing station, Calypso was the next logical place for the Huns to strike. The star system was now on the front lines of their methodical advance, and Engels had worked very hard to sweep for the enemy spy drones that would naturally be sent to reconnoiter. She'd also brought the ambush force in under emission control, or EMCON, using impellers only to eliminate all energy signatures. Standing by had Engels on edge. She paced and she sat. She inspected sections of the battleship. She went over the plan with her captains. She'd already gone over it exhaustively with Commodore Dexon, who commanded the Out-System Task Force, the one that would play the role of bushbeaters to her waiting group of hunter-killers. Dexon's fleet of fast ships lurked far out in flat space among Calypso's comet cloud, the millions of balls of ice that circled slowly around the star. A third force, composed of 12 relatively slow but tough heavy cruisers, plus Captain Jolin's SDN Stuttgart, hung conspicuously in space near C-1. The group was anchored by the local defense monitor, one that dwarfed the cruisers as a whale dwarfed dolphins. Unfortunately, there were no orbital fortresses at C-1. Lacking mobility and obstructed by the gas cloud, they would have been pointless to build, so they never had been. "Transit detected," said Lieutenant Tixban, her officer at sensors. The Ruxin fed the data to the hologram and a new icon flashed. "Far from the optimum side-space emergence point."
"They're being cagey," Engels muttered, standing to approach the hollow. "It won't matter, though. How many contacts?"
"9 so far, but they're still appearing."
Tixban swiveled an eye toward her.
"It will be approximately 30 minutes until I have an accurate estimate."
"I know, I know.
For now, take a guess and run the battle sim from their actual position." The 30 minutes fled as Engels watched the computer prediction of how the battle should play out, or at least its first half. No machine mind, not even Trinity's, could foresee what would happen within the gas cloud at C-1 and Felicity Station. There were far too many variables and too many ways for things to go wrong.
"So?" Engels said to Tixban after the 30 minutes. "As we expected, it is their 10th fleet commanded by Admiral Braga."
"Admiral Braga?"
Engels swung her head back and forth between the hollow and Tixban.
"Lucas Braga?"
"Correct."
"Then he survived the Battle of Corinth. I should be glad, but I'm not glad it's him I'm facing."
"He was your commanding officer?"
"He was. And a good man. This..."
Tixban's tentacles communicated tentativeness.
"Sucks? Is that the right word?"
Engels shook her head ruefully.
"Right. It sucks. But it won't change anything."
"It does not bother you that you will be fighting against your former comrades from the 100 Worlds for the first time?"
"Of course it bothers me, but this is war. We tried to talk to them. Today the 100 Worlds military gets to pay the price for their politicians' greed for more territory. They've shown no mercy, so we can't pull our punches."
She took a deep breath, trying to feel as confident and stoic as she sounded. In reality, she felt like she had a dagger in her gut. Admiral Braga. He'd almost held Corinth, where she was captured and her life changed so radically. She wished it were that idiot Admiral Downey she faced instead, the fool who'd blown it for Braga.
"This changes nothing," she repeated more loudly. "We stick to the plan."
"Aye, aye, ma'am,"
the bridge crew replied in unison.
Fleet composition?
Tixban zoomed in on the enemy.
8 Esteeds, 8 Diens, 16 battle cruisers, 16 heavy cruisers, 36 lights, 56 assorted escorts, and 2 fleet carriers.
Carriers? Engels leaned in. They're pulling out all the stops. Carriers were generally considered outmoded as fleet assets, too slow to keep up with escorts or their own attack wings, too lightly armored to stand and fight, and the whole arrangement too complex for the cost. Mostly they were used as auxiliaries and motherships, to carry attack ships and landing craft from system to system, usually brought in well after an area was secured, not as primary combatants.
The Rage is too long, to be sure, Tixban said, but I suspect they are being used as supply ships, to allow their fleets to operate farther from their bases for a longer period of time, and also to carry garrison forces for their conquests.
I'll keep that in mind.
The carriers might make good prizes, then, if they could be captured instead of destroyed. 4 hours later, after leisurely scouting and maneuvering, Braga's 10th Fleet turned to cruise inward and crossed the edge that marked the bubble of curved space that surrounded the star Calypso. From then on, they couldn't flee via side space, not unless they ran back across that line. 8 hours after that, Engels had returned from a meal, a shower, and a nap to watch as Commodore Dexon's ships made the short side space transit from the comet cloud into a position directly behind the enemy. In fact, they jumped into Braga's own arrival position, more or less, and now they turned en masse and began pursuing the Hun ships at full speed. Engels imagined Braga's consternation as he realized he couldn't retreat the way he came. He would believe Dexon's fleet was a relieving force just arrived from deeper in Republic territory after several days in side space, rather than a fleet that had been lurking, waiting. However, Braga shouldn't be too perturbed yet. The way ahead toward his target, Felicity Station orbiting above C-1 inside the gas cloud, would seem clear, except for Jolin's inferior fleet consisting of the Monitor Triceratops, the SDN Stuttgart, and a dozen heavy cruisers. As Braga's fleet outgunned C-1's only apparent defenders by at least 10-1, his logical move was...
There you go,
Engels said as Tixban reported the 10th Fleet had increased acceleration toward their target. Rather than cruise in at their leisure, now Braga's ships would hurry in, flip over to decelerate, and enter the gas cloud at a speed slow enough to see where they were going. They'd then have to spread out and search for Felicity Station, as Engels had made sure that the fuel factory was also under full MCON. Afterward, Braga would plan to run for the other side of the system, his mission accomplished. Or perhaps he'd expect to turn and fight, if he managed to figure out that all of Dexon's capital ships were actually light cruisers with Trinity-designed false signature emitters, the better to drive the enemy into Engels's trap. Engels bared her teeth at the thought that the 10th Fleet wouldn't get to exercise either option. 2 hours later, Braga's powerful fleet flipped over for its deceleration burn. Dexon's ships continued to hurry inward, appearing to maintain flank acceleration for dreadnoughts. Actually, the fast escorts merely loafed along, under no strain, decoy emitters transmitting at full power. Engels was glad Benota had managed to scrape so many light units up from all the surrounding systems, and doubly glad she hadn't had to give them a front-line mission. An easy victory under these circumstances would do a lot for the escort corps' morale. Engels paced, checked and rechecked everything, and bit her nails to the quick as the enemy approached the enormous gas cloud. With its glowing streamer reaching millions of kilometers in a grand curve back to the star, it was a sight to behold. She hoped Braga would be lulled into a false sense of security. Perhaps surprise and shock would minimize casualties on both sides. Jolin's force began firing railguns at extreme range. With the enemy's sterns presented, a lucky shot might go straight into an unprotected fusion drive port and wreak havoc. But the odds were slim indeed. They got slimmer as Braga's ships began varying their aspects slightly and spread out their formations. One battlecruiser took a blow from a lucky hit, and her drives stuttered and then winked out. That was the only damage done, though, until they came within effective beam range. First, the monitor Triceratops's centerline particle accelerator blazed. Nothing Braga had could match it, but he'd already anticipated the attack and launched missiles. Skirmish warheads burst between the fleets, specially designed to fill the engagement zone with gas, dust, and crystalline sand. At the same time, his ships increased their evasive maneuvers, even while continuing to decelerate. Engels muttered to herself, "Come on, come on." She couldn't help it. Even though this phase didn't matter much, it was really just a diversion designed to show Braga the resistance he expected. She rooted for Jolin's success. Every ship he damaged on the way in was one less to fight during the ambush. But Braga's countermeasures held. The particle beam no doubt brushed a few targets, but none of the drives died. The eventual addition of Stuttgart and the cruiser's fire accomplished nothing in the face of the Huns' profligate use of skirmish warheads. Engels envied their resources. No doubt they thought they would be able to burn through their loadouts and then replenish from their carrier stocks. Now, over 1,000 ship-killer missiles from Jolin's task force sprang forth in fleet strike mode. This was an all-or-nothing tactic, a full launch whereby earlier weapons were soft-launched and later weapons caught up with them, all controlled to form one attack. Given that Braga couldn't do any fancy maneuvering, every minute he delayed was a minute for Dexon's dreadnoughts to catch up to him. This meant he'd have to fight his way through. Braga launched a mix of anti-missiles and defensive ship killers, trying to trade warhead for warhead to thin out the fleet strike. Of course, only a percentage intercepted the attacking missiles as they spiraled and dodged in random patterns. ECM drones mixed in blanketed the area with confusing transmissions to allow the attackers to slip through. At the same time, Jolin continued to fire beams, further confusing the battlefield between the rapidly converging fleets. At the last moment before the fleet strike, Braga's ships flipped over as one, a beautifully executed maneuver that put their armored noses forward and brought their full weapon suites into play. Beams blazed and railguns sprayed, utterly shredding the fleet strike. There were simply too many ships, too many point defense weapons, for the Republic missiles to get through to the capital ships. A few of the screening escorts were heavily damaged by proximity blasts or bomb-pumped laser warheads, but that was poor return for the expenditure of the missiles. Or it would have been poor return if the whole maneuver weren't an exercise to lull Braga into overconfidence. Now Jolin's fleet backed up on impellers, as if their commander had made the perfectly rational decision not to sacrifice his force. Engels hoped Braga didn't wonder too deeply that the defenders didn't take the even more rational course, which would have been to back up into the gas cloud and fight from inside. Doing so would theoretically favor the defenders, limiting the attacker's ability to coordinate fire. But it shouldn't be a stretch for Braga to believe that the defense commander simply wasn't going to fight stubbornly in the face of such overwhelming odds. Furthermore, Braga would expect an attempt at an exit ambush, when he would leave the gas cloud and be briefly vulnerable to the waiting task force's concentrated fire. As she hoped, with the force in front of him out of the way and under pressure from the pursuing dreadnoughts, Braga plowed straight into the strange nebula, confident in his power. "Expand," she said, and Tixban changed the scale. Now the gas cloud filled the hologram above the bridge, and then it faded as the software removed the distracting plasma. A network of stealthy sensor drones ensured she had good eyes on every ship of the enemy. Braga's fleet spread out and fired probes of its own. Escorts formed a loose shell to recon as much of the area as possible. but they pulled back when they began to encounter a thickly laid minefield. But not too thick. Engels could have made the enemy pay more heavily, but she didn't want to risk turning them back. If the Huns had shown up with a smaller force, that might have been a problem. As it was, however, the escorts reformed in minesweeper mode, firing specialized probes and detonating any mines they found. They efficiently cleared the explosives with only moderate damage to a few ships, and the 10th Fleet advanced toward the planet C-1. Of course, they still had to locate Felicity Station. All they would know for sure was that it orbited the planet, somewhere. But Engels and her forces knew where it was. By herding the 10th Fleet at the right time with Dexon's and Jolin's forces, she'd ensured it was on the other side of the gas giant from where the enemy had entered, and it was even now using its limited maneuvering engines to stay as far away as possible.
"Helm, impeller maneuvers," said Engels. "Bring us into position. Transmit to our two hemispheres to begin surrounding the enemy."
She watched the hollow display as each half of her ambush forces maneuvered outside the enemy's range of vision on impellers only, remaining under MCON. This was only possible because she had complete intelligence on the Huns, and they had nothing on her. Her ships moved as stealthily as they were able, and soon formed a loose sphere around the enemy, with Indomitable directly in the Huns' search path.
"Activate decoy number 14, she said.
One of the many moonlets seeded with emitters over the last 3 days slowly turned on an eclectic suite of electromagnetic sources. As she'd not been sure of the relative positions when the enemy entered the gas cloud, she directed Trinity to set up more than 20 decoys. Now, number 14 masqueraded as Felicity Station, directly in front of Indomitable. According to plan, Jolin would be maneuvering his outside force into position to catch any leakers from the ambush, and Dexon would be racing forward at true light cruiser speed, much faster than Braga would expect. The time he would think he had to escape was even now flowing away like sand through an hourglass. Chapter 8 Straker and Don on Terra Nova.
"So they don't chase anyone beyond the Diz?"
Straker asked Myrmidon as they walked down the passageway behind the weird Opter Diz of Baltimore. Now and then, human facets and simple uniforms strode by on purposeful errands, ignoring the two men.
"You walk away and you're free?"
"The barriers recognize my biocode. Ordinary facets are stuck there until they meet the parameters to move on to another Diz."
"And what are those parameters?"
"None of the participants knows, at least in advance. Only the controllers know. In some, everyone moves on quickly. In others, only a select few graduate. Rather like life. Nobody knows the rules, and it's not fair."
"But you can get out."
"I can."
Straker lowered his voice. "Can we talk here?"
"Yes. Agents and their trainees are given a lot of leeway, including the leeway to speak wildly during role play."
"So you're a big cheese in the spy community?"
"Big enough to have freedom of movement, small enough that nobody wonders why I'm here."
"Like the Lazarus Inquisitors."
"Like that."
Straker chewed that over in his mind.
"I bet you're a clone."
"We're all clones, Derek. Grown in larval pods and raised in communal creches, just like our insectoid facets."
"All but me."
Don shrugged. He seemed to shrug a lot, especially when he didn't necessarily agree with something but didn't want to argue.
"Are you trying to imply I'm a clone too?"
"Clone, genetically engineered, a warrior designed and built for a purpose, grown in a womb instead of a vat. Is there any real difference?"
Now it was Straker's turn to shrug and think for a moment.
"Did you give the Mutuality their cloning biotech?"
"Of course."
"Damn it, you make it seem like humans can't come up with anything themselves."
"They can, but getting something for free,
And knowing you'll get something for free if you're one of the elite few who know about the Opter gifts makes human societies complacent, which is exactly what we want. Why work hard at research when you know some aliens are so far ahead of you? Because they're dangerous? Until now, we've been very careful not to present a military threat. Don opened a door and stepped through. When Straker followed, he shut it tight. This is Cupertino. Unlike Baltimore, the street they entered was merely drab, not dirty and littered. Drably dressed people walked the sidewalks. All the people wore mirrored goggles that covered and sealed their eyes and wrapped around to plug into their ears as well. The people were also talking to themselves, or, of course, to others, presumably via comlink. They must be viewing a virtual overlay of at least sight and sound. Some made motions in the air to manipulate virtual objects or controls. Don led them down the street to a cafe where everyone sat in his or her own tiny booth. Robots served them dull food while they continued to talk to and touch the air. "This is a diz, too," Straker said. "Doesn't seem so bad. They probably see and hear a world that's much nicer than the real one." "It's not bad at first. Yet, the suicide rate here is higher than in the one we just left." "You let people kill themselves?" "You're asking the wrong questions, Derek. You need to put aside your gut reactions to what you see."
"So what's the right question?"
"There is only one right question when it comes to sentient beings, Derek." Straker looked around, pondering, trying to remember the bits and pieces of philosophy, religion, and psychology he'd picked up in his life.
"Okay. Why?"
Don nodded.
"That's it. Why do people do things? Learn that, and you can influence them. Add power, and you can control them. And yourself."
"So why are they acting this way, disconnected from everything real, living in a virtual world?"
"You've had experience with virtuality, you tell me."
Straker thought about Shangri-La and the way he felt there. "It's seductive. It's life porn, feeding pleasure and banishing pain. But that's not real life."
"How many humans actually want to live real life? How many, when presented with comfort, take it without critical thought? In our tests, almost all of them.
If that were true, human society would go all virtual, then collapse. Only a small percentage of people actually get addicted to VR.
Don chuckled. "That's what you've been told. In reality, when everyone's doing it, when it's the way to make your living and conduct your life, it becomes the norm. The only thing that keeps everyone from going virtual is economics and regulations. In other words, those at the top keep it limited and under control."
"Why would they?"
"Because they know that a bunch of drones who've lost touch with reality are no fun to rule, and they eventually become less productive, not more."
Straker looked around. "But why do this here? What's this diz for? In fact, what are any of them for?"
"All dizzes are meant to turn facets into humans, or weed out the ones who won't adapt."
"Why?"
"You tell me."
Straker thought. "For some reason, we, don't simply want human-shaped hive drones. We want people who can pass in the real human societies. For that, they have to have real experiences, but I don't see how this is real."
Don shrugged. "They don't stay in one diz forever, they progress through them."
"Right, so they're really just progressive training scenarios."
"Of course. Let's move on. This one's called Campus."
They passed through another door into an area that resembled a large school. Pleasant but uninteresting buildings squatted among indifferently landscaped walkways. Groups of people lounged or walked here and there, always groups. They showed a mix of humanity's range of physical characteristics. Their only difference was their clothing.
Each group wore clothing of a specific color, green, blue, red, and so on. Two groups approached, reds and greens, each composed of about 15 people. Smaller groups of blues and yellows looked on. They met at a narrow point of the walkway. Straker expected them to flow through each other or perhaps each move to one side and go by. But instead, the people deliberately blocked each other and began to argue. "Why don't they just move past?" Straker asked.
"They wear different colors."
"What does that have to do with anything?" The argument escalated to yelling and threats.
"They hate each other."
"Why?"
"Different colors."
"There must be some grievances between them, right?"
"Not at first."
Straker watched as the people began fist fighting. Clumsily, though, like children. Wrestling, pulling hair, punching ineffectively.
"This is some kind of setup, right?
Another scenario?"
"Of course."
"So you made them fight?"
Don shrugged. "The Diz controllers don't force people to do anything. They merely set conditions and let human nature take over. In this case, facets new to the Diz are given colored clothing."
"And what are they told?"
"Nothing."
"Bullshit. They must be told that the other color is bad or something."
"No. In fact, there are countervailing pressures. For example, those who form detachments and other Dizzes are always given different colors."
"So those guys stay friends?"
"One might think so."
Straker turned his head back and forth from the brawl to Don. "You're saying they don't?"
"It's very rare. Within days, the new facets have nearly always adopted the viewpoints of their color. Which other colors are their enemies, which are their allies or neutral, their supposed reasons for fighting?"
"So there are reasons."
Don smiled faintly.
"Of course.
The Greens occupied a red dorm 9 years ago. The Blues beat up a yellow last month. The Purples are being favored by the faculty this term, and the Oranges paid them off. Yesterday the Reds didn't get dessert because the Blues took them all first. The Greens feel like they are underrepresented on the communal councils, and so on and so on."
"Stupid reasons to fight. Are those things even true?"
Don shrugged.
"Does it matter?" "Of course it matters. Truth matters."
"It should.
But does it?
Or is it only belief that matters?"
"You can't make something true just because you believe it."
"But what if you believe you can?"
"That's insane."
Don shrugged.
"You're totally corrupting these people."
"By giving them colored clothing?"
"By taking children, even if they look like adults, they're only a couple years old, and leading them astray."
"All we do is introduce a facet to a Diz with a certain set of conditions and see what happens. We don't tell them how to act. Once the facets experience what they need to, they're rotated out and into another Diz, where they'll learn different lessons. Eventually, some begin to develop critical thinking skills."
"And the rest?"
"They're stuck. Or they get moved to a different Diz track. Even I don't know the ins and outs. It's up to the controllers."
"Or they die, like that woman."
"Something like that."
"Come on."
Don led them to another Diz, composed of grand, beautifully decorated interior spaces. There were no windows, but warm, artificial lighting made it seem comfortable. People sat at rows of machines with screens, performing incomprehensible work. Robots rolled among them, dispensing drinks and food, so people didn't have to leave their workstations. Occasionally, someone got up from their seat to use the facilities, apparently. Some people were fat, some skinny, but all looked unhealthy. Many sucked on smoke sticks or vapor sticks while they worked. They all seemed completely lost in what they were doing, seldom speaking to anyone, even as they were packed in shoulder to shoulder. The one strange thing about the place was the noises coming from the workstations. They beeped and rang and played music incessantly. Now and again, someone would raise a hand or even jump to their feet in triumph as the machine in front of them would make loud, equally triumphant sounds. But the worker would soon sit back down and continue pushing buttons or touching screens, performing their obscure tasks.
"What are they doing?" Straker asked as the two men strolled among the workers. What's on those screens? That looks more like entertainment than work, but the people don't seem happy. Except for a few now and then, that is.
Very perceptive. It's called entertaskment. A combination of tasks and entertainment. They're rewarded with